This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four.
Episode 16, 1971, Part 2.
Well, working with Stan Lee was probably the greatest experience of my life. I had worked for the competition, DC Comics, for 2 weeks. I met Stan on my lunch hour because he had me take a little writing test, and 10 minutes later he offered me a job. Half hour later, I was back at DC and quit. You know, I'd wanted to work for DC Comics for all these years, and I went to work for Stan for like 15. And we just had a wonderful experience. I would be there every morning on his right or left hand, you know, and he would go over what he had written the day before on Spider-Man or Fantastic Four or Thor and show why he did what he did and where to place the balloons. I mean, all these things I'd never thought about as a comics fan. You know, where do you put the balloons? How much dialogue can you get in a balloon? Why do you avoid certain words, you know, maybe because letters will close up and they'll look like dirty words? You know, all sorts of strange things I never thought about. And it was just a real education. I was the one who had been the high school teacher for several years, but I never liked that. Stan was just a great teacher. And sometimes that would bear down a little heavy when it was on my work, but it was a wonderful experience.
Place to Be Nation Pop. Welcome back once again to the Marvel Age podcast. I, of course, am Nick Duke, one member of the Sarcastic Four, here to bring you the latest edition in our journey. We've made it all the way up to part two of 1971 in the Marvel Universe. But I do not take this journey alone. As always, I am joined by the other members of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with the man who is about to be unreachable, about to take a little Hawaiian vacation, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
I am doing very well, filled with the anxiety that an impending plane ride with children is going to bring. But I'm looking forward to talking all about 1971 Marvel Comics with you guys, as we do every couple weeks or months.
Has been a little while, but we do what we can. Also joining us tonight, Mr. Todd, or God Almighty, Tim Capel. Tim, how are you? God, I'm off tonight.
Man. Nick, my body is built to withstand ethereal winds, the light storms of hyperspace, but not the sheer impact of a giant hammering fist. So, that is my present state of affairs. We're going to be slumming it here in the 70s, but at least I'm in good company.
Absolutely, and I apologize in advance, folks, for my state tonight. I have just returned from a vacation myself. And as those of you out there with children know, when you vacation, you rarely vacation. So I'm utterly and completely exhausted. But in any event, rounding out the panel, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you?
I'm doing real good. I just got back from a mini vacation myself, so naturally I'm tired. And wishing Todd all the best on his upcoming, I believe it's an island vacation he's taking. Sir, I implore you to have many Mai Tais on the beach and to take chess/sex lessons from Russell Brand if and when you run into him.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. Tim may know about this, but apparently the excursion where we're going is called Krakoa.
Oh, dear.
It's the island that walks like a man.
It
but
does.
We're not going to hear about it till 1975 on this podcast. So that was an
inside reference. You may not remember this trip, but I can imagine you're still looking forward to it. So, yep.
There Don't aren't any. I'm trying to think of the Polynesian/Islander Marvel character, and I cannot think of one off the top of my head.
Me neither.
Yeah, I can't think of one either.
We're going to blame that one. You know what? We're going to blame that one on Marvel Comics and their lack of their commitment to diversity. That's what that is.
I'm going, my own headcanon is going to create one now, and I'm going to assume that douchebag Brad from the new Spider-Man Far From Home film is Polynesian of some sort. That's just where I'm going.
See, like, spoiler alert, Brad's a douchebag.
Yes.
Yes, Brad there is a Brad douchebag in the movie, and he is a bit of a douchebag.
There you go. But we're not here to talk about 2019 Marvel films. No, we're here to talk about 1971 Marvel Comics. Let's go ahead and get this show on the road, and we'll start off tonight. We'll pick back up with a book that we talked about a lot during part one of 1971, because Tim has got us reading, I believe it's every issue of Fantastic Four in 71. Tim, didn't we determine that?
I think there's one I left off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, in any event, we're picking back up here with this kind of ongoing epic of the Fantastic Four in 71. The main thrust of it is that has finally managed to somewhat cure Ben Grimm. He is able to change between the Thing and his normal human form somewhat at will. However, it has brought about with it a massive personality shift, and the Thing is on a rampage just being a giant dick. And here in 111 to 112, the Fantastic Four are like, man, you know, what else are you going to do except let the Hulk kick his ass and maybe put a little humility back into him? In full disclosure, we were going to record this episode about 2 weeks ago, and so I did a lot, about half this reading then and half this reading now, and the stuff I read then has kind of started to slip the old brain, seeing as how it was pre-vacation. I remember the Hulk Thing fight being pretty fun. The art was good. Don't remember a whole lot else. Still a solid couple issues in my estimation. Tim, you can probably give a more detailed description of what actually happened here.
No, I cannot. but that's okay, though, because it's just two issues. It's pretty straightforward. It's continuing to track this sort of ongoing saga of Ben Grimm being transformed back into his human form. Now he can sort of snap his fingers and do this at will. Like his teammates, he's no longer, you know, burdened by the power that he possesses. But he's turning into an asshole for some reason. We aren't entirely clear on why that is the case, but it's more than just a personality shift. He's going on a rampage as issue 111 progresses throughout the city. And I kind of liked, if I recall correctly, that is, just the escalation of stakes here, where it starts out, he's being a douchebag, and you're like, okay, yeah, that's the story we've been following for the past couple issues. But it just kicks into that next level where he's putting people in jeopardy. He's just terrorizing civilians. He's being called a menace by J. Jonah Jameson. We get lots of little cameos and guest shots by other characters, and it starts to feel like this is a bigger deal than it started out, you know, at the beginning of the issue. So you get the Human Torch in there. It's always fun to see them mix it up. And it's more than just the fun and games, just trying to one-up themselves, each other, with the pranks that we've seen between those two characters. Like, again, the stakes are kind of high here. You get the Hulk involved as well, and hard to go wrong with a good Hulk and Thing fight, which these two issues delivered. In the
actual like context of 1971, it'd been a little while, as I recall. I don't remember what year. It's not like this had become an overworn trope the way that Hulk versus guest appearances kind of have in the modern context. This still kind of had a fresh feel to it.
Mm-hmm. I think the first Hulk Thing mix-up that we've read was way back in FF25, I want to say. So we're still in the early 60s there. Don't know if they've had occasion to meet since then, probably. But, you know, that was one of the early Marvel epics. And this isn't trying to outdo that story, but it's still, you know, pretty decent, even without, you know, that steady hand of Jack Kirby, which we have talked about. This is John Buscema getting to do his take on a Hulk Thing fight. And I kind of like the cliffhanger at the end of 112. They're really selling it here with the Hulk getting that lucky shot in, because Alicia is trying to, I guess, break this up and course, thing. Ben Grimm still has feelings for her, despite his change in ego here. And it appears he has been mortally wounded. So how is that going to resolve itself? Well, we'll find out.
Absolutely. Todd, your thoughts here on this two-part thing, Hulk dust up?
Well, to answer Tim's question, how is this going to be resolved? I think I know. Reed's going to come up with a solution that involves Ben only being the thing the rest of the time, and that will save his life. Because every comic,
spoiler alert.
I'm just saying, if I've read a comic or two, that's how these things play out. This second Hulk thing fight that we've seen is pretty darn good. Some tremendous action drawn by Buscema. You know, they were bringing Bruce Banner into the fray for his scientific acumen. Reed was asking him to help, but he sees the thing on a rampage and transforms into the Hulk, and we get this brouhaha, and that was pretty special, pretty sensational. Enjoyed it quite a bit. We have some other subplots happening. The thing is stirring up trouble by being a douche all the way through New York City, and the citizens of New York are noticing this and turning against not just the thing, but the Fantastic Four as a whole, so their landlord naturally wants to evict them.
Oh, yes.
And Reed bops him out of there, and so there are those concerns. So was this the best thing I've ever read? No, but it's par for the course for the FF post-Kirby, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. I enjoyed the art. I enjoyed the story. It was not a slog of a read. It was actually pretty light and fun. Again, not the best characterization. I'm sorry, the biggest of consequences. This is not Galactus or the Abomination or something that's going to change the world. But as far as our characters that we care about, yeah, these are pretty important stakes. We still have the creepy Agatha Harkness Sue plotline, and she peers in and she's able to see what Reed is doing and show Sue. And I don't know. I guess this era of FF gets a bad rap, but it's pretty decent, I would say. Absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree. Russell, your thoughts here?
It was an all right issue. Yeah, it was all right. Not really doing a lot for me, but Fantastic Four so rarely does. And the Thing Hulk fight, I thought that part was good, entertaining enough, solid stuff. Nothing that we haven't necessarily seen before, though it does have a bit of a different context there with Bruce Banner actually being kind of summoned to this issue rather than just happening to be around and getting into a fight with the Thing. Kind of a bit of a role reversal there with Thing being the antagonist rather than Hulk. So that was a nice little twist, and as Todd called out, there were a couple of subplots there that seemed interesting for the sake of just being completely and utterly weird. Agatha Harkness is never going to be not just the strangest thing about Fantastic Four in this era to me. Oh, God. It's like, it's one of those things that I don't know how to react to her whenever she's there. I'm like, okay, so this is what we're doing right now. Like, all this science-based stuff, and then, there's this old witch. Yep, that's a thing. That's a thing. We'll run with that. It is kind of what it is. It's not anything really to me to write home about, but it's not a bad couple of issues either. The cliffhanger there at the end of 112 with it seemingly being, or it looks like Thing may have met his end at the hands of the Hulk. And I think Todd called it right. I think we kind of know where this was going. But, maybe they'll wind up sticking the landing in the next few issues we have to read for this for part three. We'll see. Artwork was pretty good. But I at times felt like maybe this fight scene could have been a little more elaborate or a little less, I guess, claustrophobic or crowded if they hadn't used the... nine-panel grid so much and like on every page. That's really my only issue with the fight itself. But that said, it was okay.
Awesome. Well, moving right along, unless anybody else has any more thoughts here on Fantastic Four 111 to 112, we'll talk about something that was also very interesting here in 1971. And for the purpose of this, we're going to combine all this Spider-Man stuff together, because in 1971, The Amazing Spider-Man decided to get woke. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, because they got woke, the book immediately was canceled because it didn't make any money anymore. I believe that's the way it works. I have that on good authority.
Last three issues of Spider-Man here.
Ever. Because here in 1971, we see, first up, we'll talk about Spider-Man doing something that has become, you know, in this era of comics, something of a popular thing to do, and that's to start to tackle these social issues. And here we see, in 96 through 98, Spider-Man taking on the issue of drug addiction, as Harry Osborn has become addicted to. And do we ever really determine what exactly the drug in question was?
No.
Some sort of pill, speed, perhaps? I couldn't really.
It seemed like he was taking speed at first, and then it turned into something else, or maybe he purchased something, thought it was one thing, turned out to be something else.
The larger point remains, Harry Osborn has become addicted to drugs because in a response to the stresses of his everyday life, the issues he is having in his seemingly failing relationship with Mary Jane Watson. In the meantime, you've got Norman Osborn, who is kind of starting to piece together his amnesiac mind once again and has regained the knowledge of his Green Goblin persona. And all of this combines together in what I thought was a pretty good set of issues for Spider-Man. I mean, it's Peter having to fight, you know, two different, completely different problems on two fronts, both of which involve the Osborn family, as so many of his classic stories do. He's got to try and look after his friend who he feels responsible for in Harry, and at the same time, he's got to confront the man who is becoming his greatest nemesis, Norman Osborn, as the Green Goblin. So, interestingly enough, these are non-comics code approved, which is pretty rare. Virtually unheard of, I think, at the time in 1971. And all things considered, man, I really like these. This is not really a surprise. We've talked about before, I think Spider-Man is the most consistent of the books we're reading. And that continues here, even if they are starting to lay on the social commentary a bit thicker. I still found myself enjoying it. Russell, how about yourself?
These, like you said, they continue that streak of just really great Spider-Man from this era, the 1970s. Is really on a roll here. I really loved what they were doing here. The social commentary stuff is really great. By modern standards, it's going to come off a little ham-fisted. It's not, you know, really with the times, but they were really trying, and they were actually doing a really good job with it by putting this in the context of showing how the drug problem at the time was affecting the poor and the minority and the people of color communities, but then switching gears all of a sudden and showing that no, this rich white kid over here is also using this stuff and is just as hooked on it as anyone. And there's I believe there's even a moment with J. Jonah Jameson backing Robertson's play on publishing a story about the drug problem and how it's affecting everyone, not just minority communities, and how it's everyone's problem. I found that to be a pretty forward-thinking bit of storytelling in these issues. And you mix that in with some really good stuff from Norman Osborn coming back. The return of the Green Goblin and how his mind is still fractured and a very fragile thing, but Peter of course uses his relationship with Harry to get through to Norman, which is a really good bit of storytelling. I thought that was really well done in these issues. I believe this is still drawn by Gil Kane, who continues to be just a tremendous Spider-Man artist that I can't believe I haven't been singing the praises of for years up to this point. Unfortunately, this story also gets a bit of a retcon years later, thanks to J. Michael Straczynski's insertion of the Twins story.
Insertion.
Forgot about that.
This is right about where that is supposedly retconned in, with Gwen Stacy being off in London, and Peter coming back from that trip, kind of distraught that Spider-Man had to get involved in some things in Europe and he couldn't make an appearance without giving away his secret identity. That kind of sucks that that's going to happen years later. But as this story stands on its own, it's actually really good, and I wound up really liking where Peter and Gwen wind up by the close of these issues that we read. And also, I was a big fan of issue 99, which was more like a day in the life of Spider-Man, where he goes on a talk show, like a late-night talk show. And that was just some entertaining stuff. I just found that to be like this great moment where we see Spider-Man not dealing with, you know, life-altering or world-ending kind of threats. He's living life, and this is what it's like for him. And it's just, I don't know how you couldn't be entertained by it. It is some of the best comic book storytelling, I think, from this era. And Amazing Spider-Man just continues to fire on all cylinders for me.
Outstanding. Todd, your thoughts here on these? We'll go ahead and throw in 99 as well, as Russell mentioned. These 4 issues of Spider-Man we read for this episode.
Pass.
All right, Tim.
No, I'm just kidding. Tremendous story. All the gravitas of the Goblin coming back, the dread of Peter / Spider-Man having to work for Norman Osborn, that was crazy to me. The funky 70s outfits, Peter with fringe vests and MJ performing in hair, not just hair, the musical hair, but the haircuts, the hairstyles, Aunt May going to see hair. And, what an amazing slice of 70s nostalgia this is. Early 70s, late 60s. I guess that this is very significant for the Harry doing drug stuff. I just think it's significant because you have this high drama return of Norman Osborn. He goes to a room in a building he used to own and is triggered back into being the Goblin, and then he sees Harry. Long story short, they fight, they battle, epic story. Norman sees Harry ailing, so he's triggered back to being Norman and forgets the whole thing. How convenient for that. But I enjoyed the rest of it. I enjoyed almost all of 96 through 98, particularly the things with fashion, particularly 70s icon Rip Taylor as the drug dealer that gets Harry into trouble. What an amazing mustache that man had. Also, let's not forget that Harry Osborn is the greatest Spider-Man villain, and his actions were remarkably villainous here.
I see what you did there, sir. Tim, I can hear you cracking up.
Tune in to HTF on Place to Be Nation, Bob. I mean, kind of the same sentiments here. I think it would be easy to, especially in the early 70s, go into this and have it come across as like a very special episode, right? Where it's like an after-school special, whatever you want to call it. But the drug element is sort of just an undercurrent here, and it actually, you know, informs Harry Osborn's character and his characterization in a way that plays into the larger plot. This is not something that just is going to happen and not ever be referred to again. And I thought it was handled pretty well. I mean, there was that pretty heavy-handed scene between Harry and the dealer that's a little bit reefer madness, I guess. But beyond that, it's, I wouldn't call it subtle, but it's far from what you would expect when you read a story that is known for being the Spider-Man drug issues, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's the type of thing that you figure, oh, they must have really gone all out if the comics code, you know, did not approve these issues. But no, I mean, I think almost even more controversial by today's standards than the drug element is sort of the classism that Russell touched upon. There's a great scene in 96 where Randy Robertson kind of gets in Norman's face and they like are having this big argument about their respective communities. And Randy is telling Norman that his wealth and his power confers him a social responsibility. And it's something that a lot of folks in Norman's position are going to be loath to hear. And I thought that that was handled pretty well by Stan Lee. Great cliffhanger at the end of 96 with the Goblin reveal. He's
yep.
coming out of his hideout, and all of Peter's worst fears and suspicions are confirmed. Gil Kane was just on fire in that issue. Good usage of the gang, too. We talk about the great supporting cast here, and especially this era of Spider-Man comics. It just feels like, I don't know, Peter Parker's world is just well-populated with these developed, likable characters. And they have these rich inner lives that sort of persist outside of the pages that we're reading. And I just appreciate that so much because it's something you don't really get nowadays.
Right. So, you don't really get it in this era from any other book, really. This is the only one with kind of that expansive supporting cast that isn't directly involved in superheroics.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're leaning on that as they should because it is an asset here. Did think the conclusion in 98 was a little bit too neat and pat with, you know, Norman as the Goblin seeing Harry in the hospital rooms. Like, come on. But it works for what it is. You know, doesn't really let the story down as a whole. It's like, okay, now we got to wrap it up. So, yeah, good three issues. Not what you would maybe expect going in. Sort of not what I expected. So,
and your thoughts on 99, which we kind of lumped in?
Yeah, we should talk more about 99 in general. It's a little different.
99 is a little different. Yeah, slice of life, day in the life, as Russell, I think, put it. I always get the feeling that Peter Parker just sometimes comes across as a bit of a loser when they're doing that down on his luck, oh, I'm so broke thing, which maybe that's me just morphing into a baby boomer. I don't know. But he does show a little backbone in this issue, which I liked in 99, where he, you know, is taking on this issue that he's been confronted with that clearly is bothering him. And he's been given this forum, essentially, that, yeah, is it the Tonight Show? I don't know that it's named as such, but sort of gives you that impression. I mean, it's a late night talk show, and it's got Spider-Man, so okay. So it's a little bit jarring to go from, you know, this heavy return of the Green Goblin to this thing, but it's fine as a one and done. Yeah, I mean, I think we kind of need those slice of life issues to just sort of break up and give you something a little bit tonally different in a long run like this. So go ahead.
It still continues the theme of social issues because Spider-Man uses his appearance on The Tonight Show to put over prisoners' rights, which was cracked me up just a little bit because the way it was framed.
Spider-Man taking on prison reform. Okay, so there you go.
Stan's soapbox kind of bleeding through to the pages.
Lots of,
and then the series was canceled, and that was it. So.
Yep, that was it.
Yeah, it was.
Never had another issue.
What a mistake.
Spider-Man never to be heard from again because he called out actual issues. I mean, it's what happens in comics. You got to learn your lesson, Stan.
That's right.
Absolutely.
So they legitimately, or Straczynski, I know I'm doing some time traveling here, but he's saying Gwen was gone for 10 months. How long was she gone here to have babies, fall in love? I mean, it doesn't work for me. Reading the real comics, it doesn't work for me at all.
Well, sir, you just don't understand. Norman Osborn Todd, is a true smooth operator.
Of all the things about that story that don't work for you, the timeline is it?
You know what? I remember that being a thing. No, I do remember that being a thing at the time where people were just like, logistically, you can't really. I was going to say slot it in, and that just sounds wrong, but.
You got
the next writer.
You mean Straczynski? Yeah. We were really Straczynskiing it.
I think the idea is she got knocked up.
She got raped.
It would have. Well, what are the ages here?
She's in college, so
she's a consenting age. Would
the story make a lot more sense were it a rape story?
It would, and it would be even more. It would be even more disgusting than it already is.
And a fantastic topic to cover whenever we reach whatever the fuck year that is.
I'm about 15. I apologize for taking us off topic. Also, is this our corrupt politician Turpin in prison here? A return of the Richard Nixon-esque corrupt politician with these prisoners. Is that right, or is that me not paying it as much attention as I should?
Oh, are you thinking of Sam Bullitt, the guy?
Bullitt, yeah. Turpo is not Turpin. Oh, and I also have to comment. This is the second issue we've covered where there is a noticeable lack of punctuation.
Yes, I'm glad someone said that. That, I don't know what happened there. but apparently they were trying to get away from using exclamation because you didn't see periods in comics and thought balloons and word balloons and captions. In captions, yes, but they always use exclamation marks, and I've heard it's because of just limitations of the production at the time. That was the best way to, like, end a sentence, even if it wasn't meant to be a exclamatory statement kind of thing. Like, periods didn't show up that well or something like that. And I guess they wanted to abandon that practice, but they still weren't using periods. And it's just, it kind of does mess with your brain.
Nobody else was bothered by that? Nobody else noticed that?
It was 2 weeks ago, and I don't remember.
Yeah.
I honestly didn't even notice until you said something.
If you're a big fan of periods in comics, I suggest you read Vertigo.
My lord. Okay. First, he's advocating for rape in comics. Periods in comics.
It's a good thing I own this network.
Indeed it is. The thoughts and opinions expressed here on Marvel Age are not necessarily the thoughts and opinions of the entire Sarcastic Forum.
And you know the worst part is I knew you were going to do that when I started talking about periods too. And I was like, So yeah, it's been staying bothering me.
Oh my lord. Well, with all that being said, I guess we'll move on away from Spider-Man and into something that flat out sucks in my opinion, and that's two issues of The Incredible Hulk, where, try this one on for size, folks, and stop me if you've heard this before. Bruce Banner has the powers of the Hulk taken away from him so he can just be Bruce Banner again, and somebody else tries to steal the powers for their own nefarious purposes. In this case, it's Leonard Samson, who basically steals the Hulk's powers just to get glory and then so he can steal his woman and walk off with her at the end. And by the end of it, guess what? Bruce Banner is the Hulk again. Who gives a shit, right? Incredible Hulk 141. I have no defense of it. I thought it sucked. Tim?
I thought this was kind of all right. I mean, it's notable in that we're getting
the introduction. It is like the eighth Hulk story we've read that is this exact plot, almost.
Kind of, but yeah, I mean, I'll grant you that the plot is kind of no great shakes, but I mean, we're getting the introduction of a new character who is going to become a pretty frequent supporting cast member of Hulk comics, that being one Dr. Leonard Sampson. And he's not the worst guy in the world. If anything, I thought that Bruce Banner looked like a gigantic fucking idiot in this story, because he has been cured of this horrible affliction. Why would anyone want Hulk powers, as we've talked about? Who are the people who read the Hulk comics besides us? And
I was popped for that.
You produced
who are that, the so. People that read this? And I created it.
And I mean, he's now not having to deal with this burden, right? But because Dr. Sampson is, I guess, romancing Betty, he gets jealous and decides, no, I can't let this stand. And he challenges Doc Sampson here, who hasn't really done anything wrong. I mean, he is a bit egotistical, yes. He's not the most likable character in the world, but he hasn't done anything that dastardly or damning in this story. So I thought Bruce Banner came out looking pretty bad. But it does have the good sense to not, you know, try to make us sympathize with Banner. Like, it paints him as a dumbass who made the wrong decision here. And so there's more of an ellipsis than a period at the end of this story, I thought. Also, really liked the art here by Herb Trimpe, and I think assists by John Severn, I want to say.
Marie's brother, John.
Right.
Which we'll talk. We will talk about the art, because it's very different.
It is. I thought it was very crisp, very clean art in this story. I really kind of thought that stood out from other comics of this era in a good way. So I was kind of fine with it.
I'm very disappointed. Todd, I thought that too.
This is kind of like indie comics to me. You read this and the art is so different for the time. It reads like almost like, I won't say Mad Magazine, but something you would see in the horror comics of the time, the Severin inks on it. Very different. Doc Sampson is a weird wish fulfillment thing for middle-aged men of the time. I don't necessarily get it or why he sticks around, but it's kind of this very unique single issue that introduces a character that will be around for a while, and Hulk blows it. He should have stayed Bruce, and he couldn't handle it. He had to try to challenge Doc Sampson, because Doc Sampson was moving in on Betty, and Doc Sampson still gets Betty at the end of the day. We get a lot of classic dumb Hulk dialogue. That was pretty good as well. Hulk seems to be getting dumber before our very eyes. So I was okay with it, too. I don't know that I was expecting the indie art sensibilities that I got in this, and it was definitely – you know, like almost like a American Splendor kind of art. It's very different for the period. Ugh, I said period.
Good Lord.
Russell, what are we doing?
Your thoughts.
Good Lord, Hulk 141. This is a true exercise in what are we doing?
We read different comics? I mean, just
Doc Sampson came in saying, oh, Reed Richards can be an asshole. Hold my beer.
I think that's going too far.
No, it really isn't. It's not going far enough. I don't get why anybody liked this character long enough to keep him around. This reads like an introduction of a character who should have been a one-off, one and done, go away, goodbye. You are useless. That's how I felt reading that issue. And I got nothing really like positive to say about it. I survived it. There we go. But the next issue, on the other hand, is so bad in a completely different way. It's bad in that Batman and Robin way. And that it's so absurd.
This is 142 is the what are we doing issue for me.
Oh yeah.
It is. Big time. But it's like it starts off real bad and like kind of boring, and then it goes it gets more and more absurd as it goes along, to the point where there is a six-panel page, page 14, where this pretentious asshole is just going on and on about who gives a shit what. I'm just watching Hulk in the background at a dinner party trying to pull things off of trays, and the guy just keeps walking by him like he doesn't see him. And eventually Hulk just throws the guy to the ground, takes the tray from him, folds it like a slice of street pizza, and pours everything down his gullet. And I was cackling. That was just great. But yes, this is truly a what are we doing moment. Hulk is recruited by these rich asswipes, I guess for their own entertainment, and their offer to him in exchange is, we'll give you money to buy an island for yourself so that people will leave you alone. That's it. That's the plot. And also we get a new Valkyrie in this, playing like as forward and thinking and progressive as the Amazing Spider-Man issues were. Oh boy, does Stan Lee not get the feminist movement of the day. And he takes a big old swing and a miss with this one.
In fairness, he only edited it. I think this is a Roy Thomas special.
This is 100% a Roy Thomas. Well, but this is actually an adapted comic from a short story by Rolling Stone author Tom Wolfe, who wrote a short story or longer story called The Electric Acid Kool-Aid Test. Also wrote a story in the 80s called The Bonfire of the Vanities, you may or may not have read. He probably has some other things that are notable, but those are the things I know him from. This is pretentious AF, is all I'm going to say.
Yeah, it's pretentious as hell, and it's hysterical for that. I read this completely ironically. It is not a good comic. It is just I had to find some way to find enjoyment out of it so I could keep going. Because this, I got to tell you guys, I read these issues probably like the second or third thing in the lineup for this part of 1971, and I just about couldn't do it. So I had to start finding ways to entertain myself, and yeah, that's all I could do to get through the issue.
Am I the only one who thought Samantha Parrington looked like a bad ripoff of Gwen Stacy?
You are not. She looks exactly like somebody's impression of Gwen Stacy.
Yep. Maybe she was Gwen Stacy. Instead of going to London, she changed her name. I'm just kidding. She did look an awful lot like Gwen Stacy.
And became a rich asshole.
Yeah.
And totally somehow changed became her the Valkyrie at one point.
This
wasn't really explained.
What the hell is going on with this story? This is a mainstream Marvel Comics story that was published in 1971, and it's so incongruous. It's so, what is this all about, and how is this a superhero comic that got published?
Somehow, I just imagine Stan sitting there going, oh, who gives a shit? Nobody reads the Hulk anyway.
That's exactly what happened.
Or kowtowing to, you know, pop culture. Oh, here's this writer with notoriety. Let's adapt one of his stories and change Hulk, you know, it's kind of like you could think it's like an update of the Elephant Man or something like that. It's so bizarre. This is such a weird story. I'm glad we read it, though.
I was going to say.
In a perverse way.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of think that comics like this are why we do this podcast.
Yes.
because it's one issue. It's easy for it to fly under the radar. Like, a lot of people probably don't know about this comic unless they're real diehard Hulk aficionados. But
you know, I'm glad you included this, Tim, because as you were alluding to, people forget about this era. They lionize this era of comics as thinking like everything was better back in the day, and then you give us this. And show us that, you know what? No, comics weren't all good back in the day. Some of it was pure shit. Here's a couple.
You know what they say, get woke, go broke.
Right.
Also, we have Valkyrie. Valkyrie yes. brought back, and she's still not Valkyrie. She's still this.
Still not. No, that's fixed, not Valkyrie.
What's the word I'm looking for? This projection by the Enchantress. She's not a real character that exists. She's just this projection.
A weird identity grafted onto somebody else.
And yet, we know in hindsight that she will exist.
Yeah, it's, exactly.
What a weird fucking time in comics this was. Like, I mean, Hulk just isn't finding an identity. Like, they keep trying everything, and just as they honestly, I thought that they were getting pretty close to a good through line for Hulk with that stuff that was happening in Fantastic Four. But then they go and do this and piss away every bit of that. So, yep. We've come full circle on the Hulk. He's right back to being completely absurd. And holy shit, is anybody actually reading this?
Yeah, we do get a cameo from the actual Tom Wolfe on page 16. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of you know what he looks like, but he had this iconic white suit, just
all white.
Yeah, I just these intellectuals, man.
Fuck well, me. And that's the thing. I was trying to draw parallels to today. I was really trying to, like, I knew this comic was failing as it was happening, but just trying to understand, okay, what is Roy Thomas going for here? And there is something to be said, something to this idea of kind of performative wokeness that we do see today. That is certainly a thing, but the way it's handled here is so clumsy. It just feels like Roy Thomas punching down, even though he thinks and he's trying to punch up. And I will just say that I think satire, when it is really clever and really effective, is kind of maybe arguably my favorite form of storytelling. And that ain't what this is. It just... It really isn't. It's a bizarre experiment, but I am so glad it exists.
Russell was talking about, the story is worth it if only for the Hulk in the background with the trays of hors d'oeuvres. That's yep. golden.
Which you have that is to, like, really good. Which is kind of a great example of just the sheer absurdity of this, the existence of the story, because it's based on this book, I guess, Radical Chic. Mm-hmm. And having never read it, Todd, or not really being familiar with this Tom Wolfe character, I don't feel like a sight gag of a green monster guzzling down plates of food in the background is necessarily speaking to the sensibilities or the themes that Radical Chic was trying to lay out. No. So why adapt it into a fucking Hulk comic?
Because you're thirsty for mainstream, and even though
thirsty.
Tom Wolfe's not necessarily – there we go. This is a thirst trap. You want to attach – you want to get so – you see this thing that's more successful or more respected, and so you compromise your ideals to become a part of it, right? You take the side of something that you may not necessarily agree with, but because it'll attach you to the – oh, I don't know, the alternative press or the Rolling Stone of the day. You know, you bypass the normal progression that you would have in Hulk. And that's what I see Roy Thomas / Stanley doing, you know, catering to this counterculture elitism or satirism that Tom Wolfe is doing here. And it's just saying it's kind of like selling
it's
comics
ironic,
short to me.
Yeah.
You know, yep. Comics are their own thing, and this is like it's kind of a naked ploy to say, hey, look, we want you guys to be a part of this. And comics just were cool by doing what they do to me. So I really struggle with this, why they would even do this. At least Roy Thomas didn't write he and his wife into the gosh dang thing. That would have really been too much for me.
Yeah, they kind of ironically became that which they are trying to satirize here. And I don't know how much of that is Stan or if it's all Roy or what, but it's kind of funny how that works out, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, Tom Wolfe was a guy who was known for pointing out the absurdities of the eras he was writing in. But, you know, even in our postmodern detached times, you can say, well, that's stupid. Go and do something about it instead of writing about it. To me, yeah, I can deconstruct that aspect of it. And satire works at its time, but, you know, is there a place for that in 1971 Marvel Comics? Well, there was one issue of a 12-issue monthly comic book. And it was something that I had never known existed. I'm really curious to see what some other people think of this comic. I will say
yeah,
that.
Me too.
Absolutely. Well, with all that being said, I think it's a good time to take a break. When we come back, we're going to dive into our two longer form stories that we tackled here in part two of 1971, as we're going to look at Captain America going undercover and battling the Grey Gargoyle in Captain America 139 through 142, and then we're going to kick off the classic, so to speak anyway, Kree-Skrull War in Avengers 89 through 94. So stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into the topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, this is the manager Todd Weber telling you all about what's new on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling and the Place to Be Nation pop feeds for the first week in July. Over at Hard Traveling Fanboys, my brethren Greg and Nick have started Spider-Man Month looking with a countdown of Spider-Man's top villains. We also had Geek and Sassy featuring Tim Capel talking about Stranger Things 1 and 2 getting you ready for Season 3. We also had the cutest couple in Place to Be Nation Pop. That's right, Steve and Kelly talking about the songs of 1994, Regulate and Stay, I Missed You, on their Songs with Friends podcast. Over on the wrestling feed, we had the latest and greatest talking WCW, Jennifer, Greg, Tim, all talking about War Games, The Match Beyond, featuring lots of J.J. Dillon submissions. We've got lots of great shows on PlaceToBeNation.com, iTunes feeds, Spotify, wherever the hell you get your podcasts, every week here, PlaceToBeNation.com, your only place to be in this pop culture world.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation. Oh. listeners to the Marvel Age podcast, and we continue on with this episode covering part two of 1971. We pick back up, as I teased before the break, with Captain America 139 through 142, a four-part story that sees Captain America approached by the police, who ask him to go undercover in Harlem to investigate the disappearance of several detectives and other people from around the community. And Cap, of course, does this and eventually finds that all of the disappearances can be attributed to the Gray Gargoyle. I gotta say here, one of the weird things, one of those weird, goofy villain premises that I've always kind of liked is the Gray Gargoyle. I'm not sure if it's, you know, his appearances in video games or whatever that have kind of softened me to him, but I always thought it was a you know, a fun little throwaway character that you could include for just a story such as this. We also get to see Cap and his, you know, blossoming relationship with Sam Wilson continue on. We get a lot of Sharon Carter relationship drama. Nick Fury appears in the book. It's kind of doing, I think, a pretty decent job of expanding Cap's supporting cast and giving you kind of an idea of what his life is like, showing you all these people that he has to interact with. Is it the best story in the world? No, but I don't know. It held a certain goofy charm for me, and I think Tim will maybe be in the same place with it. Tim?
Yeah, this was really only on here. Well, two reasons. I just thought of a second. One, it's an okay check in on where Captain America the series is at right now, because it's not doing any kind of big time, all time epic storylines at this stage in its existence, but you don't want things that are in that kind of place of stasis to get lost. So, good excuse to just sort of check in on the character, check in on the series. And it's also Stan Lee's final three issues writing Cap, which is a character that, for whatever reason, he's still kind of kept his hands around. We've talked about and tracked how Stan Lee has been gradually reducing his workload as an active writer, stepping away from certain characters, but you could tell the ones that he thought, for whatever reason, it was a priority for him to stick with. Those seem to be Fantastic Four, Thor, and Captain America. So, I don't know why Stan thought that Cap was a pretty big priority for him, but here he's finally turning those reins over to another writer, that being Gary Friedrich in issue 142. So, it's a little overlong at four issues for a Gray Gargoyle plot. But not horrible. I did like 139, just the character work there, where Steve is kind of lamenting that he no longer really has an identity outside of being Captain America, this guy in a costume, that his personal life is non-existent, that he's sort of lost touch with the Steve Rogers of it all. There's something to that, and I think, you know, folks familiar with this character from the MCU, that's really going to resonate. So, kind of good stuff there. This little weird mystery unfolds, and yeah, that's where we get to the Gray Gargoyle stuff, who is a pretty fun villain. There's a really bad bit in 142 where Sharon Carter has super women's intuition, apparently, now. But maybe there's something more to that going on. Don't really know, but it reads kind of badly by today's standard, by any standard. So, yeah, I mean, it's got some rough edges to it, but I don't know. It's okay as a way to just take the temperature of the character and to send Stan out to see how he wrap this run up, and it turned out he didn't. He left mid-story and just handed the baton off to another writer. So, yeah, that's Captain America in 1971.
Absolutely. Russell, your thoughts here on this four-parter?
It was like a tale of two caps. On the one hand, you've got this really interesting Cap as a man in search of an identity, trying to figure out just what his place in the world is right now, because as I think has been pointed out by other stories, one of the big internal conflicts of Steve Rogers is this is a man who has spent the majority of his adult life at war, and now there's no war to fight. So now he's in search of one. It's like he can't let it go. And he's all the while looking for something to be involved with. And along comes this, albeit odd, request of a police officer approaching a random dude in a costume to go undercover and look for missing officers. Surely they have an undercover division in the police, or like some form of investigator who could be tapped to take on that task. But sure, Captain America, that seems like that's a logical step there for the police. But that aside, it starts off to be a pretty good story. I like this whole like undercover Cap thing, be it him being like a super spy or like, you know, espionage Cap, or doing a story like this where you've got a bunch of police officers who were working undercover themselves who have suddenly gone missing. It sounds incredibly intriguing. It's like, okay, we're hitting on something here. And that first issue especially really had me as we were seeing Steve taking on this task and kind of leaving everybody in the dark as to what he's doing. That part was really working for me. Then when we reveal the villain, when we reveal Grey Gargoyle, I'll admit my eyes rolled incredibly hard. I was like, well, here we are. This is where the Cap story goes completely off the rails. It didn't go completely off the rails, just a little bit. Because I got to tell you, that whole... What was Grey Gargoyle's like motivation here, anyway?
He was going to steal Element X, which was going to help him to stabilize this compound that would enable him to turn others into stone on a more permanent basis and command them.
And, yeah, here we are again. Another I want to rule the world plot from a mustache-twirling villain who's honestly his origin was the most, like, my God, I feel like I've seen this before, and yet it's also incredibly bonkers.
He's accidentally touching parts of his body and turning into stone.
Oh, I did write down that I thought that Grey Gargoyle could really give Blue Chew a run for its money.
Oh, right, he's staying hard.
He doesn't need Blue Chew. Grey Gargoyle can just touch himself, and for a solid hour, he will be a solid hour. So there you are. But yeah, it's not really like working for me. Like, him as a villain doesn't really work. The John Romita art, on the other hand, works real well. I was really, really loving how John Romita drew the action sequences of this, how he draws the character of Cap himself, just the way he keeps the story flowing. That's something good I can really say about the art, is that it keeps things moving along. And while I'm not a big fan of Grey Gargoyle's motivations or his ultimate plot, the character work was still pretty good, definitely enjoyable, and half of a really good direction for the character of Captain America. I think there's something to this. So it's got potential. Hopefully that this will keep being built on, and we'll get to a really great era of Captain America comics pretty soon.
Todd, your thoughts here.
Do you really want my thoughts on these?
I do.
Okay. So we have not Captain Stacy, presenting this quandary to Cap, you know, investigate the missing detectives. We try to expand the supporting cast of Cap with these characters that we don't care about. I don't care about. We do get kind of a glimpse of Sam Wilson as a social administrator.
Right.
we get the worst.
Which he's shat upon for being.
Yes. Yes, he is. But then he becomes president in 4 years, which is amazing. So we also get the Grey Gargoyle, who sucks. Basic villain, terrible mustache, terrible power, terrible MacGuffin in Element X. These were kind of tedious and boring, although I did like the Romita art on the issues that Romita was credited on. He did not do the art for 140. There were no credits for these, and I can't tell you enough, as a guy who has apparently some level of OCD, the punctuation thing is killing me. To have these speech text balloons with no period, exclamation mark, or question mark. Sometimes there is one, but it's just killing me. They're dangling. Just
giant run-on sentences.
I can't handle this. at the end of the storyline in, I believe, 141, we get Nick Fury makes an appearance. We get some S.H.I.E.L.D. throughout here. And Cap's hair is getting a little bit long when you see him undercover as this police officer. Cap, that's inappropriate. You need to cut your hair. I don't care if it's 1971. Captain America does not have long hair or sideburns, friends. We get Nick Fury as Ron Burgundy talking – not Ron Burgundy, Ron Swanson. I apologize. Talking about how taxpayers' money is being wasted as Grey Gargoyle and his weird, not quite Hitler mustache are shot off into space and it blows up. So this was kind of a weird slice of 1971 in Captain America. I didn't like it. It was kind of boring, but you look deep enough, there's some Marvel weirdness there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any further thoughts on this Captain America story before we
Falcon
move
still
on?
Sucks.
Ooh, controversial.
Falcon
needs to fly.
Falcon's, yeah, still can't fly.
He's got a hook now, though.
He's got a grappling hook. That's right.
So we're getting there. One step at a time. Baby steps, you know?
Yeah. Grey Gargoyle, we should point out, is a Frenchman. So you have to read him with a comical French accent.
Well, a Pepe
otherwise.
Why does Captain America have so many French villains? France was never our enemy.
Batroc Zelipper has appear in our reading list.
Batroc.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
I always think of George St. Pierre now as Batroc.
Batroc.
I did not know Grey Gargoyle was French.
Did not get that impression from him while reading it. So
I suppose that makes sense just with Notre Dame Cathedral and all its gargoyles. That mustache. What are we doing?
Mustache, yeah. It's it's a lot.
You know what else is a lot? The main event of our evening, as we're gonna move on here to, for fuck's sake, Tim, six fucking issues of Avengers.
And three to go.
And this, of course, is
kiss
the
my ass.
We finally reached, folks. You know, we have been asking the question all along: when will Avengers get good?
Not yet.
I don't know much about the Avengers, but I kind of thought, well, hey, I know we got the Kree-Skrull War coming up, and that's a big deal, right? That's a big seminal moment in Marvel Comics history.
You said it's seminal.
Surely, even if it's not great, it's got to be at least okay to be that, you know, well remembered and kind of an iconic moment, right?
No,
right? No, fuck no. This is dog shit. Like, this is – I'm trying – okay, let me start with the
somewhat
things I like
resembling
about it.
A period?
Let me start with the things I like about it. Half of the art, which is the half that Neil Adams does. And I will say that I think in a book that has struggled to have any interesting characters at any point, I am starting to become somewhat interested in the Vision. I think they've done a good job of building that character up. The problem is he's surrounded by like eight other characters that all talk and act the exact same and who I could not give any less of a shit about. This story, which, you know, we believe to be the Kree-Skrull War, starts off in the most like roundabout way of getting to an actual Kree Skrull war, where we start, you know, in Redia Mez, or in Media Res, so to speak, with the Avengers tracking down Captain Marvel, and he's about to get away when all of a sudden he's taken out by, God help us, Rick Jones, because here we go with more Marvel being dead set on making Rick Jones a thing. And throughout this story, we are treated to Captain Marvel bits after Captain Marvel bit, Rick Jones bit after Rick Jones bit, and just none of it is interesting. None of it, like, even when they're trying to do these big over-the-top things, like the Kree de-evolution ray or whatever they called it.
Oh, my God.
Like, visually, that should be appealing, and yet it isn't. I mean, just everything about this story. I mean, they bring back boring-ass Hank Pym and Janet Pym, who have now gone off to work on a Alaskan research ship or some horseshit like that. Like, just none of this is good. The only part of this that starts to become good is when they acknowledge the goofy-ass Skrulls turned into cows bit from early on in Fantastic Four. Other than that, and the aforementioned Neil Adams art and a little bit of the Vision stuff, I got nothing for this. I got no time for this. I can't believe we have to read another three issues of this. Todd, tell me why I'm wrong.
Nick, you're right. Oh, you want me to go on? Okay, so this is decently drawn when we get to the second half. But
right.
We 89, 90, 91, good Lord, this is – but it's – I will say they're fairly quick, but we don't give a crap about almost any of it. It's very Kree heavy with Ronan, the Supreme Intelligence, and our basic Avengers team who we don't care about at this point. It's none of the heavy hitters. So much Wanda.
Yeah, Hawkeye is still Goliath.
Yeah.
You got Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch. You got Vision, and that's pretty much it. Those four, right?
Too much Captain Marvel, Rick Jones. It's just, why are we reading this? It doesn't make any sense. And then we get to the introduction or reintroduction of the Skrulls here about halfway through, and we still don't necessarily care. It's like, why are they dragging this out? I guess they're trying to tell Roy Thomas has these designs on some kind of interplanetary epic that will bring back the heavy hitters, but it's just ineffective to this point, I will say. I guess Sal did the first four issues and Neil did the last two. I can double check that, but it just in my recollection.
There was one issue where they split art duties where it was broken up into like two different chapters, and one chapter had Neil Adams, the other chapter had Sal Buscema. John Buscema,
okay. I think it's Sal for almost all of this for Avengers, for most of it.
Sal did the first three issues, it looks like. No, four issues.
Four, yeah.
Yeah, and then it switched over to Neil Adams, and then Neil Adams and John Buscema.
So, yeah, right from the get-go, when Neil comes on, it changes. You start caring just a little bit more. The stakes feel more important, and then you read the words, and it's like, no, why? But it's at least great art. For just a second, we are taken back to, oh yeah, art matters. Art doesn't just tell the story. Art can do more, can be more compelling and add, instead of just kind of fleshing out what the words are telling you, what the characters are doing, the art can actually create these memories, I guess, is the best way of saying it. Art that sticks with you. So, yeah, five issues, I believe, that were why. I don't understand the historical significance of this story to this point. But Neil Adams turns it around just a little bit for me. I would reread the Neil Adams just looking at the art and skipping the words, because I'm not given a reason to care. Why do we care about either of these entities that have no tangible connection to any of our heroes? Captain Marvel is not our hero. He hasn't done anything that we would really care about. Rick Jones is certainly not our hero. So, yeah. Kree Skrull War, I don't get it yet. Skrull War, just don't get it yet.
Tim, what are we missing here?
Oh, no. You will not find me taking up for this story. It's just here because I felt like we had to read it. And I think, I'm pretty sure it's on the original Dave Busing-produced Comic Book Herald list as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not questioning why it's on here because, like, again, as someone who's never read it, it's one of those stories I always heard talked about. So it's undoubtedly important. I just now, having read it, I'm struggling to understand why it is important.
I think that's a valid question we should be asking. In 2019, what is the historical significance to this story? I feel like it's one where enough years have passed that if it hasn't gotten lost to time, it maybe should be. because if you don't have that many years and decades worth of Avengers stories to reflect on, and mind you, this has not been a very, good series up to this point, then, yeah, you could maybe make a case for the it's kind of a milestone epic. But nowadays, I don't know. I think it probably rightfully should struggle to maintain that status. And I really do want to see what kind of feedback we get on that opinion. And the story's not finished. I don't know. Maybe it'll knock our socks off in those last three issues. I'm not holding out hope.
Perhaps. I mean, it's finally getting to the actual Kree-Skrull War, seemingly.
Well, yeah.
We read six issues, and I don't think we've seen an actual, you know, Kree and Skrull fighting one another yet.
No, it seemingly we have not, other than the Super Skrull and Captain Marvel, but those are just kind of two characters more than two races going at it. And you would think that a story called the Kree-Skrull War would, if nothing else, be pretty focused, be pretty tight in its plotting. And yet, this has been incredibly episodic. I mean, that first issue, 89, opens with this whole Annihilus finally makes it out of the negative zone. Hey, we're paying off a plot point from Fantastic Four and Avengers. Okay. Again, what's that have to do with Kree or Skrulls? Not much. We move on to that weird little excursion with Ronan and the de-evolutionary Ray. Seems like a high AF evolutionary plot, if anything. But sadly, that's not what it is. And then we move on to the Avengers have been broken up, apparently. And there's all these weird allusions to McCarthyism. Okay, fair enough. There might be a story in that. Again, why is this happening in something called the Kree-Skrull War, which continues to just play out in the background, supposedly. And then the Vision has been damaged, and we have to spend the better part of an oversized issue. Wow, if any series needed an oversized issue, it's Avengers. Whew. So we're going to spend most of the issue trying to fix him. And then we finally get to some Kree and Skrull something happening, and we've blasted off into space, and we're going to see where this thing goes in its final three issues that we are going to cover. Actually, not in our next installment. We're taking the next part off as far as Avengers goes. Yeah, thought we might need a break there because it spills over into the next year, that being 1972. It has very little going for it in terms of plot, in terms of characters. As has been said before, we aren't really following any actual characters in this series. The Vision is the only Avenger with something resembling a personality, and there's been some okay character work with him, but I don't know why Roy Thomas has this fascination with Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch and Goliath, this weird quartet we've been following in previous issues of the run. Clint Barton as Hawkeye, as Goliath, whatever, continues to be just the biggest piece of shit. I mean, giving Reed Richards a run for his money, I'm just going to say it. He is such a pile of garbage this whole I can't work with women around thing, this line that he's given, and then making zero contributions as a team player. He has been an awful character. I don't think enough has been said about this.
He wears it, though. You know, towards the end, he starts thinking, like, God, I suck. He's Vader from 1997 WWF.
You're saying he ain't nothing but a big piece of shit?
I am a big, tall piece of shit. Big, fat piece of shit.
He is. And not to body shame the man, but God, what a piece of shit. It's just, we're almost 100 issues into this series and still asking the question, when does it get good? I still think it does, but you kind of have to declare that a failure, do you not? I cannot believe we've just lucked out every time we've read an Avengers issue, an Avengers story, and surprise, surprise, it sucks. It just isn't a good series. It's not, and I'm waiting for Roy Thomas to move on here.
Russell?
Go ahead.
I think it's just feels so enslaved to the serialized format that you go back and it doesn't tell you this is chapter 4 of the Kree-Skrull War. I think he's trying to kind of piece together this longer term thing with threads and guest stars, and it doesn't work on any level apart from some pretty Neil Adams pictures. I do like you, Nick, I do like the callback to the Skrull cows. I forgot all about that, but geez, it's just, I don't care.
Well, apparently we are getting, to punctuate the thrilling cliffhanger at the end of 94, bring on the Inhumans next issue.
Oh, God.
At least there's some punctuation because some of these issues have none at all.
Yes, there you go.
Mandroids, is that like the opposite of Fembots?
My Lord. Just a bunch of stuff in an alleged Kree-Skrull war that has nothing to do with either races, and none of it is interesting. I just, man, really bad here. Russell, I know you hated it too.
Yeah, let's throw a hypothetical out there. If I titled a story,
Avengers was good. That's a hypothetical.
That's not a hypothetical.
That's not a hypothetical. Let's say I wrote a comic that says Russell takes your money and sets it on fire in front of you, and then dances around in the ashes of it all while laughing. You would expect to see that in the book. You would expect to have that illustrated, right? That's the title of the story. You're expecting that to happen at some point. Well, the title of this is, of course, the Kree-Skrull War. So for 6 issues, I have read this expecting there to be a Kree and Skrull War. You know what I didn't get in 6 long, drawn-out, boring AF issues? A Kree and Skrull War. What? I started to wonder, actually, if Tim maybe put the wrong issues in the list. I was like, could this be right? I actually Googled it at one point. I was like, okay, I got to go to Google and find out, are we reading the wrong issues? Is that a thing that's happening? Nope. Avengers Kree-Skrull War listed as issues 89 through wherever the fuck it ends in 1972. And as I'm looking at that and then looking back at the issues, I'm like, well, did Marvel Unlimited print the wrong thing? Is this, I mean, surely this story that has such accolades and adoration can't possibly be this trash. But I was wrong. It is, in fact, this trash. There is no Kree-Skrull War in our Kree-Skrull War. How? I want somebody to explain that to me. I want to know, how did this become a, put it in air quotes, classic? But, I mean, Yeah, the bar for Avengers comics is set incredibly low by this point, so I guess clearing it was the easiest possible thing. And, you know, yay, we got Neil Adams on art. That at least made it look pretty, and, you know, for two issues. Two and a half, I guess, if we're getting or one and a half if we're going to get technical with it. But there's nothing interesting happening here. All these characters, as has been pointed out, they read the exact same. Only Vision really even starts to stand out. The only good scene in the whole thing is when you get the return of the original three Skrulls from the Fantastic Four. I thought that was pretty cool. But then, all right, we separated Rick Jones from Captain Marvel. Yay! Does that mean no more Rick Jones? No, that means we're going to get more of him. Boo! And then, turns out Marvel is actually a complete fucking idiot, so we could have just left him in the negative zone. And in fact, just throw Rick Jones back in there with him. They're useless. They've done nothing to garner any kind of accolades from me. We even get a callback at one point to Rick Jones doing his like poor ass Bob Dylan impression. That was special. That was something we really needed in a Kree-Skrull war. That's what I think of whenever I think of a good sci-fi epic. And then we're getting teased with a whole thing of an Avenger versus Inhuman. And you know what? I think this caption right here at the end of issue 94 says it all. Avenger versus Inhuman. Half ellipses. And why? And why? If your own comic is asking you that question at the end of it, it's probably time to just put it away. Where can we just be done with Avengers now? Because I don't know that it's going to get good for a really, really long time. And if this is our measuring stick for what counts as an Avengers epic in the 1970s, I have zero hope going forward for this book. It's garbage, and I'm done.
But you're not done because we're going to read more in a couple months.
Because I hate myself.
We're not paying a cent for these. Well, we are through Marvel Wait. Unlimited. Well, they're not on our pull list.
I'm paying maybe a half penny too much for these books because I paid a half penny for them, I guess, whenever it's all rounded out. But yeah, that's – oh, God. What else?
Todd, I would – piggyback what you said about, I believe, issue 93 with at least the art stepping it up a little bit. That's where we see Neil Adams come on. And I'm trying to do this storyline a kindness, which it really doesn't deserve, and say that issue is a good example of how art can elevate what is otherwise a pretty mundane story. There's some nice visuals, especially in the sequence of Ant-Man going through the Vision's body, trying to repair him. You know, that the stacked vertical panels as he's falling at one point looks very good. And towards the end, like that intercutting between the fight scenes with the Avengers battling the Skrulls and Marvel with the Super Skrull, and you know, it's tied together through this countdown to the ship blasting off. Really good stuff there by Neil Adams, who is trying to do some kind of I don't know, anything within his power to lift this story up into something that is a little bit more readable. And man, the plot is just, it feels like Roy Thomas is plotting this by the seat of his pants. There's just so much stuff happening because he needs it to happen, but doesn't make any sort of logical sense. And again, not what you anticipate reading something called the Kree-Skrull War, which I suppose in Roy Thomas's defense, he was not calling it that. That was something that it became referred to as later. So yeah, not the type of story you would encounter today. Not the way we make comics today. And we are a lot better for that.
It is interesting to see Neil Adams draw icons such as Fantastic Four, Captain America for the first time. But it's not enough to elevate it to something that holds up as a classic. You know, it's like, okay, Neil Adams gets to draw Iron Man, and that's cool. We get to see Super Skrull come back, and that's cool. But, God, Captain Marvel is such a drain on these things. He's just the biggest nobody that was ever a Marvel hero. He's so boring and tedious. I hope he gets cancer and dies.
Oh,
hot damn.
I think you might just get your wish.
Huh?
Huh?
But that would be a spoiler.
Hang on. There's more. We have the Avengers getting smothered by Tribbles at one point.
Oh, God.
the Tribbles.
Yeah. Rapidly multiplying Tribbles that are threatening to suffocate our heroes. We have Iron Man casually rolling into battle with the Mandroids. He's got pop-out roller skates on his armors. What are we doing?
No one knows. No one knows. But what we are doing is wrapping things up for this time, this episode of the Marvel Age podcast. We've dumped on Avengers long enough. I'm sure we will get some interesting feedback on Twitter as a result of that. In the near future, but we'll see what comes of it. I hope we do as well. I want someone to explain to me what there is to like about Avengers from this really first 10 years of Marvel and explain to me what it is I am missing. But in any event, before we bid you adieu, we will end the show as we always do by giving everybody an opportunity to plug their shit. Tim, plug your shit.
Okay. You can find me on Talking WCW on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. If you did not catch that in the live read, hint, hint. We had an episode dropping in early July covering three matches from the War Games series. So, fun one to do, as everything on that show is. Do check it out. On Twitter, you can find me at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-6-8. Tell me why I'm being too harsh about these Avengers comics. I know that us dumping on Avengers feels like sort of an in-joke. We do it a lot, but it's not because we're trying to. We keep saying, when does the series get good? We want it to get good, and it's just not getting good. So tell us if we're just missing the appeal here, please.
Tim, I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Did any of those War Games matches feature James J. Dillon?
We did not cover the 80s War Games. No. It's not quite what the show is. We considered it, each of us, but no, did not choose one of the 80s.
So you have the Ultimate Warrior.
Do what now?
Ultimate Warrior.
No, we did not do the 98 War Games either. No.
Good to know.
Did any of them feature the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan?
No, they did not.
What are we doing?
Hey, I will stand by the match that I picked. I cannot speak for my compatriots on that show. I thought we all had three really good matches, though. Genuinely good matches.
All right,
I'm not going to tell you what they are.
I want to understand. You had one match each or three matches each?
Okay, so for people who do not listen to Talking WCW, the premise of the show is that there are three of us, myself, Jennifer Smith, and Greg Phillips. We independently watch one match and then come together and talk about it. So three matches total are talked about on each episode of Talking WCW, which you can find on Place to Be Nation Wrestling.
So you watch one match and then listen to two other people talk about the one match that they watched.
We each choose a match. We all watch the same matches.
Okay. I get it now. So you do have to watch all three matches.
We all have to watch the matches that are chosen. It's just we each get a pick.
I was about to accuse you of being very, very lazy, Tim.
In what way?
Watching one, I would just having to watch one match and then do a podcast about it.
And then telling people about, well, this is the match I watched. It was really good.
I mean, it's not like this is a Mission Indie Possible type podcast or something like that.
Well, it's not for me to say.
Todd, while you're questioning Tim, go ahead and plug your shit.
Hey, my name is Todd Weber. I co-host a show called DC For You every week with Russell Sellers, who will tell you about that show. I also host something called Conversation Comics, which will eventually come out with an episode about the death of Dark Phoenix / Jean Grey, featuring our own Tim Capel of the Sarcastic Four. I also sporadically host a show called Binge Please when the feed needs shows to fill out its schedule. That show will come out as well. So follow me on Twitter at Todd Weber Guitar or on Instagram at Guitars of Green. Join our Place to Be Nation comics group on Facebook and leave a review for us on iTunes for the Place to Be Nation podcast feed and maintain our 5-star rating.
Helps us a lot.
Outstanding. Russell, plug your shit.
As Todd mentioned, he and I co-host a weekly show here on the Pop Feed called DC For You, taking a look at all the fun, great, and just sometimes weird and off, and even sometimes bad in DC Comics. The month of July is all about Superman. We just kicked off with an hour-long special called Superman For You, which is picking out his greatest stories from comics, television, and film. And we were joined by our special guest, Stephen Ferrari of the Casual Geekery, who is probably the biggest Superman fan I know. And he had some really great insights and just a great conversation with him talking about all things Superman. And for the rest of the month, we've got a bunch of other shows coming up covering things like the pilot episode of Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, and, of course, the classic Superman story, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. All that, lots more coming up on DC For You. Of course, always listen to the Marvel Age podcast and its sister show, Marvel Age Masterclass, with host Ben Morris, and usually one of us.
Is Lois and Clark still on the DC Network, whatever it's called?
It is indeed. It is still on the DC Universe app. And
I feel like they're rotating movies but keeping the TV shows constant.
Yeah, the TV shows are pretty much the same. The comics are all staying. It's just the live action and animated movies seem to rotate on and off as they continue to appear on other streaming services. And for more on that, of course, and lots of other like fun and oftentimes boring subjects, you can follow me on Twitter at Russell_Sellers and use that same name for Instagram.
Absolutely. You can, of course, find me at NickDuke87 on Twitter. I'm around on the Place for Nation Comics Facebook page. And you can head over to the Pop Feed where you can hear a little podcast by the name of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, which is, by the way, the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. We have just wrapped up X-Men month and are moving on to Spider month is what I'm going to call it. We just had our countdown of our top five favorite Spider-Man villains. In our next episode, we're going to have our HTF special review of Spider-Man Far From Home. Spoiler alert, I enjoyed it very much. So tune in to hear all our thoughts there. Well, that'll about do it from all of us here at the Sarcastic Four and the Marvel Age podcast. Be sure to tune in next time on the show as we're going to move on to our final part of 1972. Wrap up our 1972 discussion.
71, my friend.
71, whichever.
Nice.
I'm trying to move ahead. Yeah, I'm trying to move right past the conclusion of Kree-Skrull War and move on. But anyway, part three of 1971, just to give you a heads up, you can find this over on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. The reading list is pinned to the top. But real quick, we're going to cover Fantastic Four 113 through 116, Amazing Spider-Man 100 to 102, Thor 191 to 193, yes. Captain America 143, and Marvel Feature number 1, which is notable for the
first appearance of the Defenders. So be sure to stick with us. Keep listening to Marvel Age.
Big issues coming up.
Absolutely.
Think about it.
Yeah, pretty exciting. I'm actually excited about the next episode as opposed to this one.
Plus, we're going to go through and pick our favorite cover, favorite story, yada, yada.
That's right.
You're in awards
coming up, too.
I don't foresee Avengers winning any awards there.
Perhaps not, yeah. So hitting the main event scene of 1971, getting out of the undercard here, the mid-card. Ugh. Yeah,
it was something of a slog, but yeah. Be sure to check us out next time. We'll cover all those books, give you our year-end awards. So for all us here at the Marvel Age Podcast, we hope you've enjoyed it. Enough said.